The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi all, Amber Hunt here. We have some news at Crimes of the Centuries. As of now, this show is part of Grab Bag Collab, the Patreon-based podcasting network I founded with Tony Award-winning actor and podcaster Daisy Egan and Amanda Rossman, my longtime collaborator on all things journalism, most notably our hit investigative podcast Accused, which was named a top 25 true crime podcast by Rolling Stone magazine. Now you might be wondering, what does this mean for me? Well, it means that if you're interested in getting early ad-free episodes of Crimes of the Centuries, you can do so at patreon.com/grabbagcollab. And if you do that, you'll have access to a hodgepodge of other shows. Right now, we've got an advice podcast about secrets called Dear Daisy, a gossip-laden game show hosted by Rebecca Lavoie called Other People's Problems, a Love is Blind recap show called Shut the F Up, Nick Lachey with Daisy and Broadway superstar Ellen Marsh, plus much more to come. Here, though, we'll give you a sampling of the show most aligned with Crimes of the Centuries. The Catalyst is a program created, narrated, and edited by Amanda Rossman and me, and co-written by historian Jen Erdman, that delves into the upbringings and evolutions of some of history's worst criminals. This serves as just a taste of what else you'll get over at Grab Bag Collab if you subscribe to support Crimes of the Centuries there, too. Remember, to join, go to patreon.com/grabbagcollab and feel good knowing that whatever money we make there, we share with all of our creators in the hopes of making more content for years to come. Please stay tuned for The Catalyst. People interested in true crime are always baffled by the why. Why would someone do these things? What path in life could possibly have led them to commit such atrocious acts? In this podcast, we aim to explore the upbringings and backgrounds of some of history's worst criminals, but with a twist. Because we want you to set aside what you already know about them, we won't use their names until the end of the show, so you can listen anew and hopefully get insight into the question that haunts us the most. Why did they do it? Join us as we explore The Catalyst. In December 1977, in Wichita, Kansas, 25-year-old Nancy Fox worked two jobs to make ends meet, one at a law firm and another at a jewelry store. Little did she know, a man had been studying her for weeks, following her and learning her routine. According to FBI profiler Special Agent John Douglas, this man believed that Nancy Fox was the perfect victim. She lived alone, had an established routine, and had no roommates. She was also cute and of the right age. One afternoon, the man told his wife a lie about needing to leave the house, giving him hours to himself. It was 8:30 p.m. when he broke into the empty apartment. Nancy was still at work, so he used the time to cut the phone lines and get comfortable in the space. He was ready for her when she arrived home nearly an hour later. He told her another lie. He said he was going to rape her, that he was sorry about it. It was a compulsion, but he had to do it. Nancy Fox lit a cigarette and responded, "Let's get this over with so I can call the police." Once they were in the bedroom, he told her to lie down on her stomach as he put on rubber gloves. He used handcuffs for her wrists and tied a yellow nightgown around her ankles. As he seemingly prepared to rape Nancy, he grabbed his belt off the floor and wound it around her neck. A few moments later, she was dead. He masturbated into her nightgown before beginning to tidy up. Replacing the handcuffs with red stockings, he also tied several pairs of stockings around her neck. Satisfied his perfect victim had been laid out perfectly, he rummaged through her things looking for trophies. Settling on several pieces of her lingerie and jewelry, plus her driver's license, he packed the rest of his things. There was just one last thing he had to do before he left. He turned up the heat as high as it would go. He had taken some criminal justice classes at WSU and learned that room temperature affected the rate of decomposition, which would make any autopsy more difficult. Nancy had fallen victim to a man we will call the Boy Scout.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
The Boy Scout was born to William, a city utilities worker, and Dorothea, a bookkeeper, in 1945. Like many who grew up in farming communities of the era, his first few years were spent living under the roof of his paternal grandparents. His parents lived there as well, all pitching in on the wheat, dairy, and cattle farm in Pittsburgh, 110 miles from Wichita. In his later interviews with Special Agent Douglas, the Boy Scout said he felt different even as early as this. His first voyeuristic opportunity came while he sat on the back porch of the picturesque farmhouse, watching his grandmother twisting the heads off the chickens that would be their dinner. Douglas, in his book about the Boy Scout, wonders if this was the moment he may have been corrupted, when his young mind began to equate death and sexual arousal. The Boy Scout's family moved to Wichita when he was around five in 1950. They settled into a three-bedroom home on North Seneca Street on the northwestern edge of town, only 10 minutes from his dad's new job at Kansas Gas and Electric. Those who grew up with the Boy Scout remember him as a shy, quiet kid who didn't participate in the neighborhood stickball games that were all the rage at the time. Maybe that wasn't a huge red flag, but this could have been. One winter day, when the Boy Scout was in sixth grade, the snow kept the students inside for recess. That's when he and two friends began drawing what he labeled a quote-unquote girl trap. His friends went along with this, agreeing that they knew plenty of girls in their class who were annoying. But the trap that the Boy Scout was drawing in colored pencil was a slaughterhouse based on none other than the murder castle designed by H.H. Holmes. He had read about Holmes in his murder hotel and become obsessed. While his two friends drew the interiors of the hotel, he drew steel cages and flames that shot out of walls to roast his victims. When their teacher came over to see what the boys were furiously whispering about, the other two boys had the decency to look ashamed. But the Boy Scout excitedly began to explain how it would all work to his teacher. One of those friends would later sobbingly tell profiler John Douglas that he knew something wasn't right at that moment, but he never would have guessed his childhood friend would turn out to be such a horrific killer. In 1955, when the Boy Scout was about 10 years old, his family bought its first TV. All four boys loved to watch the Mickey Mouse Club. According to Psychology Today, around the same time that he was drawing his terrifying picture of his murder castle, he had a raging and violent crush on arguably the most popular Mouseketeer, Annette Funicello. Except where other kids fantasized about taking her out on a date, perhaps even marrying her, the Boy Scout wanted to kidnap her and tie her up. After graduating high school, he stayed around Wichita for a few years, working at the same grocery store where his mother worked as a bookkeeper. He attended Kansas Wesleyan, 90 miles north, but left after a year to enlist in the Air Force. With less than stellar grades and the Vietnam War ramping up, he was a prime target for the draft. By enlisting, he was able to control the branch he entered and possibly his assignment. Not wanting to be a pilot, he was unlikely to see the kind of combat other men his age were seeing in Vietnam. When his training in San Antonio was finished, he was stationed at various bases around the world: Turkey, Greece, Korea, Japan. Finally, away from the conservative Kansas environment, He frequented sex workers where he was able to indulge in some of his bondage fantasies. By 1970, the Boy Scout found himself back in Wichita, his Air Force commitment finished. Soon after returning home, he met and married a woman named Paula, and the couple bought a home in nearby Park City where he worked at a Cessna plant. He ended up getting laid off from that job 3 years later. The economic downturn prevented him from finding another job for months, meaning Paula became the breadwinner for their family, something that didn't sit well with his controlling nature. With nothing better to do than drive Paula to and from work, he had plenty of time for his fantasies. Recording many of them in his journal, it wasn't long until mere fantasies were no longer enough to satisfy the beast within. That moment came in January 1974, when he first spotted the Otero family. He spotted them while driving Paula one day. Just as his family was on their way to start their day, the Oteras were climbing into their station wagon and pulling out of their driveway to do the same. Over the next several days, the Boy Scout stalked the family, learning their routine, trying to find out any information he could, and attempting to figure out what about them enticed him. That final question went unanswered. Whatever drew him to the Oteros, he found himself crouching in the snow next to their house on January 15th, 1974. The door was locked, but he used the time to cut the phone line and put on his black ski mask. At 8:40 a.m., the youngest son, Joey, opened the back door to take out a bag of garbage. Grabbing Joey, the Boy Scout forced him inside and quickly surveyed the scene. Clearly, they were getting ready to take the younger children to school, making lunches and checking homework. Joseph Otero Sr. thought it was all part of a joke. Quote, "Did my brother-in-law put you up to this? Come on, tell me," end quote. But when the Boy Scout brandished his pistol, 33-year-old Julia Otero screamed and began to plead for their lives. The Boy Scout ordered the family to go into the front room, where he told them the cover story he'd come up with just in case there was trouble. He said it was an escaped felon and was looking for food, money, and a car. But he was unsure of his footing and terrified of losing control, so he forced them to move again, this time to a back bedroom where he told them he was going to steal their car to get to California. Making Joseph Sr. lie on the floor, he taped his wrists together until he was sure it would be impossible to escape. As he turned to Julie, he calmed down and, according to John Douglas, began to ask them questions. What were their names? Where did they work? What did they think was the best way out of town? He killed Joseph Sr. first, then Julie, then 9-year-old Joey, then 11-year-old Josie. That was the scene 15-year-old Charlie Otero came home to later that day. Opening the door to their home, he was met with quiet. He had 4 siblings. Their home was never quiet, so he knew something was wrong. 2 weeks before his 16th birthday, Charlie had to go through the unimaginable horror of discovering more than half of his family slaughtered. In an interview 45 years later, Charlie told the Wichita Eagle, quote, "When I saw them, I hated God. I lost my religion," end quote. Rushing out of the house to find help, a neighbor heard his cries and came over to the house. Seeing the horror inside, the neighbor attempted to call the police, but realized the phone lines had been cut. When the police finally arrived, they were stunned that such a crime had been committed in the light of day and in such a quiet neighborhood. Given the brutality of the crimes, law enforcement wondered if there was possibly an organized crime element. But once they investigated the Otero's backgrounds, nothing suggested any connection to any crimes, let alone organized crime. Feeling relatively confident that he'd gotten away with his family murder, the Boy Scout found his next target the same way, while driving with his wife in the car. Only 2 months later, as he was taking his wife out to lunch, he noticed Catherine Kathy Bright getting her mail. John Douglas described that the Boy Scout later wrote in his journal that, quote, "the image of her jean jacket and beaded purse burned a black hole into his brain," end quote. Over the following weeks, he cased her house. There was a vacant lot on one side, while the home on the other side seemed deserted. It looked perfect. By this time, he was enrolled at Wichita State University, majoring in, of all things, administration of justice. On April 4th, 1974, he sat through his morning classes and then drove to Kathy Bright's house. Just as he did with the Oteros, he cut the phone line before he broke in, but this time the house was empty. Deciding that was actually to his benefit, the Boy Scout used the time to plan what he wanted to do and exactly where it was going to happen. When the door eventually opened, he had it all planned down to the second. What he hadn't planned for was someone else walking through the front door. Kathy's brother Kevin entered the house first, followed by his sister. In an interview with John Douglas, the Boy Scout said he felt overwhelmed, but managed to put a sibling in each of the two bedrooms. Unnerved, he wanted to dispatch the brother first and shot him twice in the head. Then the Boy Scout turned his attention to Kathy. He attempted strangling her, but grew frustrated with how long it was taking, so he grabbed his knife. As he stabbed her, he heard the front door open. He reached the front window just in time to see Kevin, the man who had just been shot twice in the head, stumbling down the street. Thinking he had maybe only minutes before the police came, he grabbed his kill kit and ran out the door. Over the next few months, his anxiety was heightened, waiting for the moment the police knocked on his door, but it never came, even though Kevin had survived and his sister's murder became regional news.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
It would be 3 years before the Boy Scout's next murder, but it's unclear whether that long gap was because of the close call with the Bright siblings or because of the birth of his first child. Regardless, in early spring 1977, he spotted his next victim, or who he thought would be his next victim. He would later tell John Douglas the biggest lesson he had learned from Kathy's murder was that he should remain flexible just in case things don't go as planned. If conditions weren't right, he would bail, like he should have done 3 years ago. Or he could pivot, like on this night. Instead of killing his intended target, he spotted Shirley Vane's son walking on the sidewalk. Pulling a picture of his own family, he walked up to the boy and pretended to be a cop, asking the boy if he recognized the people in the photo. Obviously, the little boy didn't and went on his way, but the Boy Scout watched carefully to note which house he entered. 10 minutes later, he showed the same boy his gun to force his way into the house. Stepping inside, he found two other children watching TV and their mother, Shirley Vane, homesick from work. Locking the three children in the bathroom, he forced Shirley into her bedroom. As he bound her with black electrical tape, he explained how he was going to rape her before killing her and then her children. But after binding her ankles, Shirley vomited. The Boy Scout got her a glass of water and then ignored her pleas to not hurt her or her children. The phone rang from the living room, causing the children to start crying again. Likely frustrated, he looped a cord around her neck and pulled tight. Remembering that Josie Otero had initially woken up after he'd tried to strangle her, he added a second cord and then a plastic bag over Shirley's head. As she fought for her life, he masturbated over her, and when she was still, he ran from the house. When he wrote his after-action report in his journal, he said he wished he'd had more time to be able to kill the children, as he had specific plans for them. Shirley's children managed to crawl out of the bathroom window and run for help. The Boy Scout would kill again in 1977, just before Christmas. This was when he took his next victim, Nancy Fox, whom we described at the beginning of this episode. But here's the thing about the Boy Scout. He craved attention. The boy who had sat in the back of the classroom, blending in, was now doing the one thing he was truly excited about and proud of, and he needed people to see it, to be talking about it. At this point, he already had scrapbooks, that's plural, full of articles about the Oteros, Kathy and Kevin Bright, and Shirley Vane. Someone would have to find Nancy, who lived alone, before he would be able to add new clips to his collection. He didn't even make it to noon the following day after killing Nancy before he dialed the police and said, "You will find a homicide at 843 South Pershing, Nancy Fox." When the local news played the 911 call a few nights later, the Boy Scout's wife, Paula, said sleepily to her husband, "He sounds just like you." A gap most likely explained by the birth of his daughter, Carrie, born in 1978. This new life as a father of two small children also explained why his next victim lived only five houses down from his own home. Maureen Hedge always waved to him when she was in her front garden, but something clicked in April 1985, something that created a picture in his mind of Maureen with a rope around her neck. Even though he knew a cardinal rule of serial killing was never kill in your own neighborhood, he couldn't seem to help it. He became fixated. To avoid suspicion, he snuck away while on a Boy Scout camping trip with his son Brian. Saturday, April 27th, after dinner, when the campers were sitting around the campfire, he began complaining of a headache and retired to his tent. Grabbing his kill kit, he snuck out of his tent and walked back to town. From there, he got a cab to his neighborhood, climbing through backyards, including his own in-laws, until he landed in Maureen's yard. Not for the first time, he broke into an empty house and waited. When she got home, he had to wait a little longer because she had brought a man home with her. As soon as she was alone, he, quote-unquote, pounced like a tiger, as he described it to John Douglas. But, as had happened before, when the Boy Scout fixated so intently, that's when things tended to go wonky. Before he could prepare all of his tools, he wrapped his hands around her neck. Thinking she was only unconscious, he handcuffed her and wrapped a ligature around her neck before realizing Maureen was already dead. Given the special circumstances of this murder, he knew he had to change his MO, so he decided to move his victim for the first time. He knew, again from his criminal justice classes, that remains found outdoors made investigations much more difficult and, if he was lucky, weather might wash away evidence. So he rolled her in a blanket and placed her into the trunk of her own car, which he then drove to Christ Lutheran Church, aka his family's church. And since it was their church and part of his persona was a dutiful parishioner, the Boy Scout had a key. Letting himself in, he carried Maureen to the basement and laid her out on the floor. A few days earlier, he had taped black plastic all over the windows just in case he wanted to use the space for his nefarious deeds. Now here's where things get even weirder. Over the next few hours, he played what John Douglas called a deranged fashion photographer and posed Maureen's body in a variety of positions, searching for the perfect shot. Of course, several shots included bindings, while in a few, he had arranged her clothes in what he considered sexy poses. He was so engrossed in his morbid photo shoot that he didn't realize the time until sunlight started peeking through the black plastic. Gathering up everything, including Maureen, he drove 6 miles out of town where he dumped her body in a ditch and covered her with leaves and debris. He snuck back into the Boy Scout campground, relieved to see everyone was still asleep. Elated, he got to work scrambling eggs and cooking bacon for the hungry scouts that would soon awake. Even with another victim, the Wichita police had no leads in the search for the Boy Scout. Since 1974, local, state, and federal law enforcement had dedicated hundreds of thousands of hours and millions of dollars, but nothing of substance had been found. The only actual clues were those that the Boy Scout had led them to himself. Just like with his excited phone call to police after Nancy Fox's murder, He would leave behind little clues, and if the stupid people couldn't find the clues, he would be forced to call and lead them to it, or at least that's how he saw it. By 1991, the law enforcement team in Wichita was made up of exactly one detective, Lieutenant Kenneth Landwehr, and he told the local press that the chief of police had ordered the case to remain open because they had no more reasonable leads to follow. And there the case sat, on Lieutenant Landwehr's desk for another 11 years. Out of the blue, the Wichita Eagle received a letter from the Boy Scout on March 19, 2004. The newspaper reported that the seemingly innocuous letter arrived with the morning mail, read by news clerk Glenda Elliott, who then gave it to Tim Rogers, an assistant managing editor. The letter was supplemented by a photocopy of Vicki Weggerly, the victim of a 1986 unsolved murder, and three photos of Weggerly, each showing her in a slightly different pose. In each image, she was dead. Suddenly, the case was relatively hot again. Another letter arrived on May 5th, 2004, this time sent to KAKE-TV, the Boy Scouts' favorite news station. This included photocopies of two work IDs of two different men, one who worked for the Southwestern Bell Phone Company and the other for a local school district. Police confirmed that the phone worker was alive and well and confused, but the other ID led nowhere. No one by that name existed, and the logo used had been discontinued. For reasons known only to him, at least for now, the Boy Scout had resurfaced and was once again craving the media attention that sustained him decades earlier. All that law enforcement could hope was to stop him before they found another victim.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
The task force roared to life. By 2004, DNA technology now existed. In April, they received word that criminalists at the Sedgwick Regional Forensic Science Center had managed to, quote, link the DNA extracted from a semen stain on the blue nightgown found at Nancy Fox's house with the skin fragments scraped out from beneath Weggerly's fingernails, end quote. Now they had forensic proof that linked a minimum of two murders claimed by the Boy Scout. The communications kept coming. One particularly perplexing part of the package was when the Boy Scout asked if the police had found his previous missive that he'd left at a Home Depot. Landwehr and his team had absolutely no idea what he was talking about. What Home Depot packet? After finding nothing either inside or outside the local home improvement store, they managed to find something on the grainy surveillance footage of the parking lot, a man putting something into the bed of a pickup. And by an amazing stroke of luck, the truck belonged to a Home Depot employee, and even though he had thrown it in his trash, it hadn't been collected yet. Most of the message inside read like the rest of the Boy Scouts' taunts, except for the last part. It read, quote, "Look, be honest with me. If I send you a disc, will it be traceable? Just put the answer in the newspaper under miscellaneous section 494. Run it for a few days in case I'm out of town, etc. I will try a floppy for a test run sometime in the near future, February or March," end quote. After getting over the surprise that the Boy Scout was asking them this kind of question, Landwehr placed a classified ad in the January 28, 2005 edition of the Wichita Eagle, telling him to go ahead and send that floppy. A purple floppy arrived at KAKE-TV 3 weeks later, accompanied by a locket on a gold chain, clearly a trophy stolen from one of his victims. As soon as the news organization realized what they had, the padded envelope was turned over to the task force. Landwehr told John Douglas that the entire task force was gathered around a computer screen as their tech expert popped in the disk. There was only one file, named testa.rtf, that read, quote, "This is a test. See 3x5 card for details on communication with me in the newspaper. Any communications will have a number assigned from now on in case one is lost or not found," end quote. It took only minutes for investigators to nail down the identity of the person who created the file and determine it was created on a computer owned by Christ Lutheran Church. Detective Stone, the technical expert, pulled the church up on Google, and within seconds, the pieces that had been circling Wichita for three decades began falling into place. Christ Lutheran Church was in Park City, and the person who created the file just happened to be listed on the website as the church's congregation president. And who was this person who was still using floppy disks but didn't know how they work? Well, that would be the Boy Scout. The task force began to carefully trail the Boy Scout. Landwehr told John Douglas they'd had too many close calls. They wanted to ensure they kept tabs on him and, most importantly, make sure there weren't any more victims. While they watched him from afar, the task force needed to shore up their case. In one of the Boy Scouts' early messages, he threatened to blow up his house if the police ever closed in on him. They wanted to have as ironclad a case as possible before they made a move. This meant tying the Boy Scout to the DNA found at some of the crime scenes. But how could they do that without tipping him off? This is where the investigation headed into some very gray territory. A detective suggested that, well, they couldn't get a DNA sample directly from him, they could maybe get a sample from a relative. Ray London, a special agent with the Kansas Bureau of Investigation, remembered that the Boy Scout's daughter, Carrie, attended Kansas State University, and that most students use the on-campus clinic. Agent London drove the 130 miles to KSU and found that Carrie had used the clinic several times. After returning with a court order, he came back to Wichita with slides containing cells from Carrie's last pap smear. With another court order in hand, he dropped the sample at the crime lab in Topeka. After those tests were done, London and his entire task force had what they were hoping for. They had DNA proof. The arrest was a coordinated operation that included the FBI, KBI, and Wichita Police. D-Day was February 25th. From their surveillance, they knew the Boy Scout left his office every day at 12:15 and drove the 3 minutes home to have lunch with Paula. Agents waited until he was on a side road to entrap him in a pincer move. The Boy Scout immediately jumped out of his truck, but he didn't bolt. Agent London told John Douglas that, quote, "he went quickly without much effort," end quote. London also recalled that everything about him was calm, cool, and flat, especially when the Boy Scout looked him in the eye and said, quote, "tell my wife I won't be home for lunch. I assume you know where I live," end quote. The trial began in the summer of 2005 as Kansas braced to relive 30 years of trauma. But to everyone's surprise, the Boy Scout confessed to murdering 10 people in open court on June 27th. An insanity plea had been ruled out, and for him, this was his best, or only option, at getting a reasonable sentence. He then proceeded to describe each of the 10 murders in detail without any hint of remorse. At his sentencing on August 18th, the Boy Scout monologued for 30 minutes without apologizing or saying anything of note. Once he finally sat down, according to the Washington Post, the Boy Scout, aka Dennis Rader, the BTK killer, that's bind, torture, kill, was sentenced to 10 consecutive life sentences with a minimum sentence of 175 years. As you can imagine, Rader's family was reeling, devastated from the moment police notified them of his arrest. They didn't know him to be the monster capable of doing the things he described in court. In early 2007, Paula filed for an emergency divorce. According to the Wichita Eagle, Kansas typically requires a 60-day waiting period for divorces, but Judge Eric Yost waived that, signing the papers the very same day they were filed. It should be noted, too, that Charlie Otero's life seismically changed when he found his family dead years prior. The surviving members of the family were sent to New Mexico to live with relatives. Unsurprisingly, Charlie suffered from periods of instability, periods of being unhoused, and he spent some time in prison. He moved back to Wichita in 2008, where, according to a 2019 Wichita Eagle article, he was living with his fiancée and happily working at a motorcycle shop doing repair work. According to the article, Charlie had even begun to come to terms with living in the same city as the man who killed his family. He told the Eagle that he used to give the prison the middle finger whenever he was driving by, but he stopped. He decided to let his hate for Rader go. He said simply that he was, quote, just tired of carrying that weight, end quote. To research this episode, Jen Erdman read former FBI profiler John Douglas's book, Inside the Mind of BTK, The True Story Behind the 30-Year Hunt for the Notorious Wichita Serial Killer. Additional sources included several articles from the Wichita Eagle, the Washington Post, and Psychology Today. The Catalyst is a production of Grab Bag Collab, created and engineered by Amanda Rossman and narrated and edited by Amber Hunt. You can support us and our other programs at patreon.com/grabbagcollab. That's GRABBAGCOLLAB. Special thanks to Daisy Egan for being our first pass editor and a collaborator on Grab Bag. Music comes from Soundstripe Inc., my dad, Bruce Hunt, and my son, Hunt Van Benskoden.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.